The 4th of July weekend's a time to party, and most of those parties involve booze. Americans consume more than 6 billion gallons of beer every year, not to mention hundreds of millions of gallons of wine and hard liquor. Clearly, there's something about alcoholic drinks that we like. In his new book, Proof, Adam Rogers traces human alcohol consumption back thousands of years. He goes as far as to say a good drink is the culmination of human achievement.
That's a moment for us to engage, whether we realize we're doing it or not, with the entire history of the human connection with nature, the entire history of the human connection with technology, with our own inventiveness, and with a deep connection to the world that we live in, that we're a part of, to the nature that we're part of, because of course the whole process depends on a 200 million year old organism, depends on yeast. No matter what you're drinking, there's fermentation involved, and yeast do that. So that moment of having the drink is us having traffic with 200 million years of deep time evolution, with 10,000 years of human history and civilization, 2,000 years of technology, and then with if we can be interoceptive enough about it, if we can understand our own responses to what we're drinking, it's relating to the way our own bodies work, to the way our senses of taste and smell work, which are these very direct senses that we interact with the world around us with, and with how our body responds to things, how our brain can change from moment to moment. So there really are these very deep entanglements with the universe that happen through the simple interaction of ordering a drink from a bartender and taking a sip.
Well, the first humans who had alcohol had no bartenders, and I was imagining, you know, rotting fermented fruit, laying fruit or something vegetative, because as you mentioned, yeast is what makes everything ferment, lying on the ground, maybe bees are buzzing around. What do you think made that first human pick up a rotting piece of fruit and taste it?
You know, it's really interesting because when we try to tell ourselves these evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology stories, it's very easy to get trapped in the kind of just so universe of like, well, it must have been like this, right? And of course, we don't know because that predates any history. The oldest kind of historical evidence of human beings fermenting something to drink it, if you believe this evidence, and I do, it's good research, 9 or 10,000 years old. So if you want to go back millions of years, you know, when did humans or some primate ancestor of humans start to consume this stuff? There's an interesting hypothesis from a guy who's very good at this kind of deep time research named Stephen Benner, who says that about 10 million years ago, in a primate ancestor of humans and chimps, the enzyme that humans still have that processes ethanol, that helps us digest ethanol, which is the alcohol that we drink, got about 50 times more efficient than it had been before that. There was an evolutionary change in that enzyme. And he suspects that's about when that primate ancestor went from being arboreal, right, from living in trees, to being terrestrial, to being on the ground, when you would find those falls, those fruit falls that would at that point could be fermenting in the environment. But this is, you know, it's not speculation because there's some good science behind it, but of course there's no way to look back and see if that's the way the story unfolded. But you know, I like a 10 million year old 10 million year old glass of whiskey, I suppose, would be a tasty drink. Nice vintage.
I'm talking with Adam Rogers about his new book. It's called Proof, The Science of Booze. That's fermentation. The other half of it is distillation, which when one reads the book, you will walk us through. But you trace the science, people thinking about distillation, back to this Egyptian woman, interestingly enough, named Maria. Who was she and what did she do that, or what she may or may not have done, that was so groundbreaking?
Yeah, I do love the story. And of course, as a story, it's one that historians and historians of booze particularly could poke at. But I love it so much that I tell it in the book as my favorite possibility for the origin of distillation. So Maria, she's referred to in the history as Maria the Jewess. That's, you know, don't write letters. I didn't name her that. But that's what that's what her biographers named her later. And she's a fundamentally important person in the history of alchemy, right? And sort of the almost science that predates what we think of as science today. So when we think of alchemists, we tend to think of people in the Middle Ages or medieval times, Isaac Newton, people trying to turn lead into gold. But of course, they were trying to understand the work of people who were doing science in places like ancient Alexandria at about the turn of the of the common era. So, you know, sort of just before the birth of Christ by the calendar to just after it. And Maria was a scientist in Alexandria, probably not working at the library, the famous library of Alexandria, but working in one of the other places, the sort of temple, laboratory, university kind of hybrids that they had in the city at the time. And Alexandria was a fascinating place because it really was the first modern city. It was built on a gridiron to take advantage of prevailing winds coming off the desert. It had a beautiful lighthouse. It had a harbor. It had places for research. It had plumbing. They loved automatons. They had all of these kind of robot things, mm-hmm. like when you opened a temple door, the statue of a god would move and catch fire. They were fascinated by machines. They were a city of engineers, you know, the first city of engineers. And in that environment, Maria is doing research, and she's trying to understand, like the alchemists, how the universe works. And the alchemists were pretty much wrong about everything they said mm-hmm. about how the universe worked. But what they were right about was that you had to do experiments, right, to understand it. You couldn't just sit and think, which was kind of the Aristotelian mode. And Maria made lab equipment. You had to make your own lab equipment. So, for example, there's a kind of double boiler that people still use in laboratories called a bain-marie or a Marienbad, Maria's bath, right? She invented that. And if you believe this account and if you believe her biographer a couple hundred years later, she also came up with a way to heat something and then make those vapors recondense. So you heat it, get vapor to come off, and then turn that vapor, which is a kind of separating out whatever that thing is made of, back into a liquid. And that's what a still is. It's a separation technology. It's like a filter or a centrifuge or a gas chromatograph. It's a way to separate the molecules that are in something into their constituent parts. And she's the one who came up with it.
I thought that was fascinating, not only because she was a woman operating so long ago, but that whole idea of distillation. She wasn't looking for alcohol, but you can trace her back to a couple of guys that you write about who are really... They run a distillery in California where they were working with things like, what do we do if, could we distill a sweet potato? I mean,
That's right.
They seem like scientists, not like alcohol makers.
Yeah. So you can trace a fairly direct connection, even if you don't think that it's Maria who came up with the still.
I'm going to believe
if you
it.
Just wanted to, I go with it too. But okay. If you wanted to just go with, let's say the physicians in Salerno in the 1100s who started distilling stuff to drink, you know, when they were making kind of the herbal-based spirits that you can actually taste something that was very close to what they probably were in a drink like chartreuse or Benedictine, right? Which is probably very much like what those first things that we made to drink from a still were. You can really trace not just the intent and the approach, but the technology that they're using to the kind of still that you would find the place that I describe in the book, a place called St. George Spirits in Alameda. It's right here in the Bay Area where I live in California. And it is one of my favorite craft distilleries. It was one of the early successful craft distilleries. Now there are many around the country. And you know, these folks have a big still that they make the stuff that they sell, and they have a small lab still where they do experiments. And really, it looks an awful lot like the drawings that Maria drew or that we ascribe to Maria still mm-hmm. today.
Can you make an alcoholic beverage out of anything?
Well, anything with sugar, right? I mean, yeast are really finicky eaters. So you and I'm assuming that you don't have superpowers. I do not have superpowers, which means that you and I cannot digest cellulose, for example, right? That's wood or paper. So a termite can, for example, because of microbes that live in a termite's gut. We can't. But you and I can digest starches, which are complex sugars, which are sugar molecules attached to each other in interesting patterns over and over and over again, repeating patterns, right? Mm. We have enzymes, amylases, one of them in our saliva, even before we chew and swallow. Starches start to get digested in our bodies. But yeast can't do that either. They can't digest cellulose. They can't digest starch. They can only digest what a researcher will call a simple sugar. One molecule or two molecules attached together, things like glucose or sucrose, right? So anything that contains those sugars, like, let's be very basic, sugar cane, right? Cane mm-hmm. has a lot of that. Grapes have a lot. Grapes up to 25% simple sugars. Yeast can start eating those right away, and yeast excrete carbon dioxide and ethanol. The carbon dioxide are bubbles, right?
Right.
And ethanol is the alcohol that we drink. Now, where that starts to get tricky is if you want to make an alcoholic drink out of an agricultural product that is mostly starch, which would be something like a grain, mm-hmm. right? So a barley or corn. And if you're going to do that, then you need the enzymes. So in the West, we go through a process called malting. You know, you've heard of single malt scotch, right?
I have.
Single malt whiskey. So that is a whiskey that's made at one specific distillery and has a lot of other appellation controls around it. But fundamentally, what's going on there is they're malting the barley. They're letting the barley germinate. They're letting it grow a little bit, which begins the biochemical processes of making these enzymes that break down the starch, which is there for the little embryo in the seed to eat. It's like it's the equivalent of an egg yolk, right? It's the it's the nutrient for the embryo. In a plant.
You're saying yeast as if it was a singular, but in fact, I had no idea until I read your book that there were many kinds of yeast and that brewers and distillers have particular yeasts that they believe yields the beverage that they create.
They do. It's really interesting to me, actually. So certainly the brewers care deeply. The brewers will go down to the individual level of strains. And in fact, I spent a little bit of time in a place called White Labs in San Diego that sells a bunch of different strains of yeast to craft brewers and home brewers. And they'll let you taste beer that they make that has all the same ingredients done with the same recipe and under the same conditions, which you would never do for beers because fermentation time and temperature and all that stuff are all things that change depending on whether you're having an ale or a lager or a pilsner or, you know, all those different Hefeweizen and all those different kind of beer subcategories that we see at a bar or a restaurant. They'll keep all that constant and just let you taste a different yeast in each one, which I can almost taste the difference.
I was going to ask you, can you taste the difference?
I could taste differences, but many of them were, I will admit, too subtle for me to detect. But they are there. And different, you know, the yeast like different sort of environments too, and different temperatures and stuff. So you would never make those all the beer the same way. But the brewers care a lot about that. The vintners, I'm generalizing, but the vintners actually think that their yeasts often are the wild types that live in their vineyards because yeast like to live on grape skins. And some distillers think that their yeast line is the one they have to use. Some of them think that it's a commodity and they'll buy their yeast from big factories. But yeah, there are different strains and, in fact, some different species as well. Some brewers actually deviate from using Saccharomyces cerevisiae, right? S. cerevisiae, which is the classic baker's and brewer's yeast. But some brewers will use Brettanomyces, a whole other species with a whole different flavor profile. It gives off a whole bunch of other weird stuff besides the ethanol and the carbon dioxide that we're mostly interested in, because they're trying to get a different flavor.
I'm speaking with Adam Rogers. His new book's called Proof, The Science of Booze. Well, there's a lot of science, but I'm sure that a lot of our listeners who are not brewers or distillers, of which there are many in our listening area, I should say, are wondering, yeah, why are you talking to this guy? Just get him to tell me the secret for ordering a good drink. So what is the secret for ordering a good drink?
Wow, you know, I have changed a lot in the course of working on the book, as you might imagine. But I have come to believe, first of all, I try very hard to make myself believe that anything that a person wants to order, if they're drinking alcohol and whatever they order and they think tastes good, you have to, don't be judgy, right? So if people want to order a chocolate martini, man, if that's their drink, I try very hard. I fail in not being judgy, but I try very hard to not be judgy about it. But I have... I've kind of come around. I really like whiskey a lot, and I drink a lot of different kinds of those. I drink American whiskeys, bourbons. I drink single malt. I tend to order things that are weird. If I see something behind a bar that I've never seen before, I tend to want to know what it is just to kind of know what's going on, because apparently that is my shtick. but I had this conversation with a guy named Dave Arnold, and he's a kind of a wizard with booze and with food. He runs, among other things, he runs a bar in New York called Booker and Dax, which is a very science-minded bar. It's a really interesting place. A lot of strange techniques going on behind the bar. But he said, you know, it used to be that you could go into any restaurant in the country and there wouldn't be a menu. And the chef would just be expected to know how to make a bunch of different stuff, and they'd have the ingredients for it. And then that changed because we started to want to know what the chef was good at and what the chef thought was fresh that day and important to make that day and was showing some piece of what he or she thought was going to be the best to come out of that kitchen. And similarly, it's still, we go into a bar and we expect any bartender to know how to make any one of, let's say, 24 drinks that we've heard of, right? Mm-hmm. And we test them. We play stump the bartender. Have they heard of a Corpse Survivor number 2? Do they know how to make or remember the main? How good is their Manhattan? That kind of nonsense, right? But now I've started really ordering from the menus that in a bar that's interested in a cocktail program, let's say, and not all bars are, they don't have to be. Different bars have different shticks of their own. But if there's one that's interested in a cocktail program and I'm interested in getting a cocktail, I want to know what the bartender, what the person running that program in that bar thinks is the best and thinks that will show the best for what that bar is good at. So I've started ordering from the menu that they put in front of me, and whatever the house, like, oh, you've got a weird invention that's a variant of a cocktail I've never heard of with strange house pickled onions, yeah, set it up. Let's see what you guys are doing.
We are speaking just before the 4th of July weekend. Do you have a particular recommendation for 4th of July partiers?
I saw a great, this is not me, I'm stealing this a little bit from one of the various booze websites and email letters and stuff that I subscribe to, pointing out that one of the original American spirits was actually rye. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of great ryes out there. Many of them actually come from the same distillery, weirdly, and they're bought by different labels and packaged differently. And that's all fine because they still taste pretty good. But, you know, rye with ice is a pretty good thing to be drinking while you're grilling. And then, you know, the classic is beer. And I would say that there's a lot of good locally made American beers now. You can go pretty much in any, well, you're in the Pacific Northwest.
Yes, we have a lot of
beer.
You're
in the hub of fantastic craft beers. I don't have to tell you about
that.
That probably would be the thing.
And anything that we should make sure that we keep out of the hands of the person sitting closest to the fireworks?
Avoid, if you're running fire, don't be touching the fire water.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll plan to be drinking a chilled rosé on the 4th of July, because that's
a lovely choice.
It's my lovely choice. Adam, thank you so much, and thank you for writing a most entertaining science book.
I'm so glad you liked it. Thank you very much.
And you have a good 4th of July.
You too. Thanks.